Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Today, Friday, was to be the deadline for Florida and the 49 other states, plus the District of Columbia, to hand over voter data to the White House. But the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity has told the states to hold off for now as it deals with legal challenges. Now, this commission was created by a presidential executive order on May 11th. This is White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders describing it on that day.
The commission will review policies and practices that enhance or undermine the American people's confidence in the integrity of federal elections and provide the president with a report that identifies system vulnerabilities that lead to improper registrations and voting.
So what does this presidential commission want? It asks the states to see full names, addresses, birth dates, political party affiliations, voting history back to 2006, the last four digits of Social Security numbers, military status, and other state registrations, felony convictions, and overseas citizen information. That's what it wanted. Why does it want the information? To investigate baseless claims of widespread voter fraud. Howard Simon is the ACLU executive director, one of the groups suing over the order. He called it naive not to appreciate the fact that the commission is different. He said it was radically different than other previous presidential commissions. So all of this as the request awaits a federal judge's order. So what of your voting information already is publicly available here in the Sunshine State? What isn't? And why? And what do these have to do with voter registration and voter turnout in Florida? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to join the conversation. You can also tweet us your thoughts about voter information and the Trump administration. At WLRN on Twitter is our handle. Sergio Bustos covers the state of Florida as a senior editor for Politico. He joins us on the telephone. Sergio, what was Florida's response to this request?
Well, one thing, it took them a long time to respond. A lot of states had already responded pretty quickly once the Trump administration, at least the Election Integrity Commission, asked for it. But eventually they did respond and said, you know what,
Oh, we just lost Sergio. That was my mistake. We will call him back. Dara Kam is also with us, the News Service of Florida. Dara, tell us, we know that, as Sergio was describing, it took a little bit long for Florida and the Secretary of State here in Florida to respond. When it did, what was the response?
The response was, we are going to give you what's publicly available. And I think that, but I think that some voters, as I wrote in a story this week, kind of freaked out when they found out what was publicly available. And if you're interested or if your listeners are interested in what is publicly available from the voter registration rolls, which interestingly is not available from other public offices, like not from the tax office, not from the driver's license office, but a lot of this same information gathered by these other government agencies that's exempt from those agencies, you can get if you go to the election supervisor's office. I'd be happy to share what that information is.
Well, absolutely. Give us one moment here, Dara. But the response from Florida was, we'll give the commission what's already publicly available.
Right.
Intimated in that is this other stuff, Social Security numbers and others, we're not going to send along. Was that explicitly stated, though,
that's
by
true.
The state of Florida?
No, but I think it was understood. And, I mean, they laid out what was in public information. It wasn't clear from the letters that were sent back and forth. What you cannot give out, what is exempt for everyone, is the last four digits of your Social Security number, or even any of your Social Security number, your driver's license number, and your signature. This is information that is gathered by elections officials, but is not a public record. So that was part of what was being sought by the president's commission, but which Florida said, no.
Yeah. Voter data, your information as a voter in the Sunshine State, what we're talking about here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. Do you feel comfortable if the state of Florida decides to give your voter information to the Presidential Commission looking into election integrity? Is that okay with you, or would you prefer it to be just within the state of Florida? And for that matter, the voter information that is publicly available, is that okay with you? 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Sergio Bustos is back with us from Politico. Sergio, my mistake on cutting you short earlier. The response from the state of Florida.
It
was not the Russian government.
It was
completely operator error on my part. Absolutely.
Up, yeah.
Yes. But as the state of Florida had said, its response to this request from the Presidential Commission on Election Integrity, it will give over what is already publicly available. All that's on hold right now. What's the status of it?
Yeah, I mean, what the Trump administration, the Election Integrity Commission is trying to do is, it's much like what the Scott administration was doing back in 2011. They're looking for what I would call an illegal voter in a very large haystack. That haystack in Florida is 13 million people. And voting fraud experts will tell you that fraud is not going to happen on election day, but it's going to happen in the absentee ballot voting. This is where people can get a ballot, send it in, it's all done. That's where, in my experience as a journalist, both when I worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer and here at the Herald too, the Miami Herald when I worked there, that's where the fraud is most likely, because that's where campaigns can really make trouble.
And we've seen that certainly in the past. South Florida has a history of stories of trouble with the absentee ballot, haven't we, Dara?
Well, yeah, I mean, and Sergio can speak to this in more detail. I'm grunting in an agreement because of the boleteros down in Miami mm-hmm. that have been paid to gather these absentee ballots and fill them out, and people have been paid to vote a certain way. So there's a lot of corruption, and there has been a history of corruption in those, and they
right.
don't call them absentee anymore, just so we know, so we don't get
mail-in
any letters.
Ballots,
so,
right.
Right.
Yes, they're yeah. mail-in ballots,
but
we all know that.
But let's
right?
let's put this historic problem, certainly in Miami-Dade County, in perspective, Sergio. We're talking about a county with hundreds of thousands of registered voters, hundreds of thousands of voters in this 2016 campaign. What's the scale of the problem that we know historically has existed in Miami-Dade County? And for that matter, would that kind of problem, if it existed in 2016, be captured by the information that the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity is asking for?
Well, again, the information that's asked, they do give out all the information you talked about, but obviously they're not going to put down who you voted for. So you're not going to know that anyway.
Right.
All you know is that the person did, just the basic information. But also think of this. Think of what, put yourself in the minds of a criminal, right? When criminals steal ID, credit cards and the like, it's because they can get a lot of money from it. What's the motivation of someone, one single person, going to vote illegally? Again, it's the campaign that's trying to, maybe in a very close election, try to find dozens or hundreds of votes. Again, I would point to absentee voting as the way to do it, because you apply for an absentee ballot in most states. In Florida, you know, you can simply apply one, get one, and vote by mail. And these are the ways that I think perhaps this commission ought to be looking into, because in the last election, I think more than half of Floridians voted by mail or voted early,
right, right,
as opposed to election day.
And voting.
I really feel like it's important for us to say one thing. This commission, as Sergio said, that it's like they're looking for a needle in a haystack, but it's really not even a needle in a haystack, guys. This is really like and I hate to say this, but it's really, there is no evidence that there's this massive amount of voter fraud.
The study after study has found a lack of evidence.
Yeah,
Dara, you're right. This is
to say that.
This is looking for a head of a pen in a hayfield. That's what
this
is about.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But back to an earlier point, Dara, that you mentioned, there is already a lot of information publicly available if you are a registered voter in the state of Florida.
That's true.
Why is
that? And I think that's what's scaring voters right now. Why is it? Sergio can back me up on this. I'll tell you why. Because campaigns and consultants want this information so they can target voters, and it makes it a lot cheaper for them if they can get this information from a state agency and they don't have to pay for it, or they pay it's very cheap, and they don't have to go to the kind of efforts they would normally have to, where they create some kind of a fake poll and get people to sign up online. And so they can get this information, they can target. Also, the folks who are doing districting, reapportionment, and creating, helping the state lawmakers to create new districts, they've got voter information data down to down to my garbage can in my backyard. So this is campaign driven. This is why this information was made available. And I think it was 2004 or 2005 when a lot of this information was protected, and now it's available. Some folks in the media will say, and First Amendment folks will say, well, you know, this gives us the opportunity to look at voter data and information. You know, I gotta say, like, I'm not in that. I'm not sold on it. I think that there's a lot of information, particularly emails. Many listeners may be unaware that their emails, when you sign up to get a sample ballot from your election supervisor, your email becomes a public record, and all of the information that's attached to that for you as a voter is also available.
Talking about the effort on the part of the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity to get voter information from the state of Florida. That effort is on hold, waiting for a federal judge to rule on what has been requested from plaintiffs for a temporary restraining order, essentially, to put it on hold for the time being. Comment from one caller in Miami Beach here, Dara, wondering if people may stop registering to vote if they're concerned about all this publicly available information could be turned over to the federal government. You detailed some of those concerns in a recent piece you published this week, but it goes further than that. It's not only just the information on this Presidential Advisory Commission, but it also goes to what we were just discussing, which is the volume of personal information in the state of Florida that's already subject to public availability.
That's right. And so what do we do? I mean, do the election supervisors ask for some of this information to be made exempt? It's exempt for certain classes of individuals like police officers or law enforcement and judges and other people. But, like, here's my idea. I came up with this on my own, I gotta say. So, guys, give me a pat on the back if you like it. And listeners, give me a pat on the back if you like it. I think voters should be able to opt out. If you don't want your information shared, like you do when you sign up for J. Crew or whatever on your email, right? You get on some email. If you don't want your information shared with every Tom, Dick, and Harry, why shouldn't you be able to say, I want that information to be kept private? Sure. I understand, like, as a reporter, and Sergio probably going to beat me up, and I'm, you know, not, but I think we should have that option.
Sergio, we're the Sunshine State. Florida has led the way with sunshine laws and government transparency. Is the Dara Khan principle here about opting out of voter registration information that's publicly accessible advisable in your estimation?
Well, I think at the end of the day for us and the journalism business would rather not see that, but, you know, it's not a bad idea. On the other hand, again...
Wait a minute. He said it's not a bad idea.
Not advisable, but not a bad idea.
But I would say that if you go back and read the letter that the elections folks here in Florida wrote back to the commission, you'll find that they made it pretty clear up top, we can investigate our own election problems, thank you. And I think that was the message a lot of states are trying to send to the Election Integrity Commission.
I do want to bring this back to the 2011 experiment.
And we know that the department, I was just going to say, we know that that Governor Scott's administration did such a darn bang job of that back then.
Well, and this was in 2011 when Governor Scott ordered the state to identify and remove non-citizens. The then current Secretary of State looked at this. 182,000 were identified, but the Secretary of State in Florida at that time actually refused to go through with the governor's order. He resigned. The new Secretary of State, who's the current Secretary of State, came into office. County election supervisors then refused to go through with this removal. And the federal court actually, Sergio, wound up stepping in, declaring this entire effort illegal.
Yeah, again, it was a real reach back then, and I remember they did come up with a couple isolated cases. I think there was a gentleman from New Zealand who voted illegally, but they also purged a gentleman who had was Italian but had served in was a U.S. citizen,
right.
Had been in World War II serving the country, and he got knocked off, so he had to go and explain that, look, I'm a U.S. citizen, I have the ability to vote, so... But again, it was so few isolated cases that, again, I'm not sure if it really accomplished what was set out to do, which I go back again to the idea that it's the absentee ballot fraud, which is the real source of problem.
So, Derek Hamm, as Florida voters await for a federal judge's ruling in Washington, D.C. regarding this national effort, whether or not this White House Advisory Commission and its request for voter information will be able to go forward or not, we are facing special elections in Dade County for some legislative seats. And, of course, looking ahead at the big 2018 races, the U.S. Senate race and the governor's race, not the least of two, which are going to certainly attract a lot of attention. What are we to make of this effort?
Well, I think that voters are really freaked out about it. I mean, as I wrote about it the other day, the voters... First of all, it's highlighted to them how much of their information is public already, which they didn't know. They're concerned about being put into some sort of a national database that they don't know what that's going to be used for. It's created distrust on for voters with their local elections officials who are very frustrated because they are believe in the in the voting process, and they don't trust the state officials, the local officials, and certainly not the federal and even not the federal government. And so it's created one thing I have to say is that it's created uncertainty for voters and this demand, this rush of information, and questions for voters. But it's not an election year for us. And so I think that makes it a little bit safer so we don't have a massive self-purging at this point.
I will state that WLRN did invite several county election supervisors to the Florida Roundup today to discuss this issue. None of them were able to take us up on our invitation. Let's go to the phones in Oakland Park in Broward County. Pat is on the telephone. Pat, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Your thoughts. Go ahead.
Hi. I heard Dara say what pieces of information actually were released. I'd like to hear them again. She went through it pretty quickly.
Sure. Go ahead, Dara. The information that Florida voters, that's already publicly available.
That's the name, the address, the date of birth, the phone number, the email, the voting history. What that means is whether you have voted or not, and the political party. What is not released is the Social Security number or the last four numbers of the Social Security number, the driver's license number, and where they have registered to vote, where they register to vote and their signature.
And Dara, just a clarification, by where they're registered to vote, you mean the address in which the voter registration is current?
No, their name and address are not where they first registered to vote. Your name and your address are public record.
Are public record. Sorry. Pat, what do you believe about that? What are your thoughts from Oakland Park?
I spoke with the supervisor of election in Broward the other day, and they told me that your history of voting and is not available without a subpoena, and that I believe the party you're registered to was available.
Yeah, your political party is, and my understanding is your voting history, how frequently you have voted. I know this is a public record. Sergio, you know, we've seen campaign voter files where folks have targeted super voters who have voted in every election.
Yeah.
So whether you voted or not, how you voted, obviously, is secret. So
it's secret unless you want to tell somebody. But right, Sergio, the frequency, how often your registration is used to cast a ballot,
right,
either at a public polling place, either early voting on election day or requesting a mail-in ballot, that's recorded and that's part of that's publicly accessible here in the state of Florida, isn't it?
Yeah, and remember, that's information both major parties, Republicans and Democrats, when you're running a campaign, you want to know,
yep,
is this a frequent voter or someone who hasn't voted in two elections? It's very crucial information to go after and not waste your time on someone who votes every year, every election cycle. But if you're looking for people that maybe haven't voted a while, or you're not interested in that person because you don't think they're going to vote in this election, that's information that's very crucial.
Let me bring in one more caller here. Mary is joining us from Hollywood. Mary, you're on the radio. Your thoughts?
I would like to hear you all talk more about what I think is the real issue. I think you've all agreed that there is no voter fraud issue. For me, the issue is that certain actors are trying to purge voters from the rolls, because it's a well-known fact that when more voters vote, Democrats tend to win, and when fewer voters vote, Republicans tend to win. And you see, there's not a lot of Democrats behind this voter fraud, so-called voter fraud action. What do you think about that?
Mary, good thoughts. Dara, how about from you, a Republican effort to tamp down Democratic turnout in Florida?
Well, I don't know that it's the attempt to tamp down Democratic turnout in Florida. Certainly, the president made clear why he was creating this commission, was because he believed that 3 to 5 million people cast fraudulent ballots, or there were maybe not live people, but there were this many fraudulent ballots cast for his opponent, a Democrat, and that's why he lost the popular vote. So I don't think there's any secret that it's a Republican who is saying we could talk about, the fact that there were this many fraudulent votes and they all happened to vote for the same person, the ridiculousness of that. But
right, right.
But I don't...
There's a lot of jumps in logic on
yes,
both sides of claims. And Sergio, one of those pieces of logic, which is very commonly held, and Mary articulated it, was when voter turnout is high, that tends to favor Democrats. When voter turnout is low, that tends to favor Republicans. Do we know if that's true in Florida?
I'm not going to venture to go that far. I will say this, and maybe
I can,
it's a perspective
I can help
from
with that.
Well, from South Florida, the perspective is that we have people here from all over the world, a lot in Latin America. And when you really look around the world and see how difficult it is in some places to vote, and I mean legitimately difficult because of violence, because of persecution and the like, you've got to admit, and I know people may not like this, but I think the American system does make it as easy as possible to vote. Are there problems that could be fixed? Yes. The one I would point to is if you've served your time as a convicted felon,
mm-hmm,
I think you should be able to come out and vote. I think that is made difficult in Florida. But otherwise, I mean, really, if you look at the numbers, people just don't vote, period, even though I think it's quite easy to do so.
Just real quick on this idea of low turnout favors Republicans, high turnout favors Democrats.
It is true, and this is why Democrats have better options or possibilities for election in presidential years. They do show up in greater numbers in presidential years, and the evidence in Florida, at least so far, is that when Democrats turn up in bigger numbers, that they have a better chance of winning. I also would like to say just that the election supervisors really do believe that we have a system that is impervious to fraud, and that they encourage people to sign up. I sound like a cheerleader, but I can't help myself. They really do not want people to run away from the polls because of their fears. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is our right as part of a democracy.
Certainly is that. Derek Hamm with News Service of Florida, Sergio Bustos, senior editor at Politico Florida. Thanks to both of you here discussing voting and voter information in the state of Florida and nationwide. Still to come on the roundup, the fight against fighting the bite with Nailed in South Florida. Do you support using the insecticide against mosquitoes? As the roundup continues after this. Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Twice already, a plane has taken to the skies over Miami-Dade in the battle against mosquitoes. One has flown over Weston and parts of western Broward County, too. The use of Nailed to fight the bite is a fight itself. Mia Carlson is a mom living in South Miami.
I would like them to maybe pump on the brakes and wait a little bit and not be so aggressive in the chemicals that they're using. And if they are going to be using those chemicals, I really think that they need to do a better job of communicating the dates and times that they're using them.
This week, a federal judge threw out a lawsuit filed by two people from Miami Beach over using the chemical in the aerial spraying locally. The spraying this year has not targeted the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes. That's the breed that carries Zika. Instead, it's targeting the more common salt marsh mosquitoes. It was about 1 year ago when a Miami-Dade woman and a man in Broward County separately tested positive for the Zika virus. Those helped lead to an unprecedented travel warning by the Centers for Disease Control for the Wynwood neighborhood, and then similar warnings were eventually put up in other areas, including Miami Beach, for months last year. So do you take special precautions when there will be aerial spraying for mosquitoes? What are the protocols to decide when and how to spray and how to tell the public about the spraying? And what about the use of Nailed? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. Kate Stein covers the environment for us here at WLRN. Anton is along with us as well, Director of Mosquito Control for Broward County. An, let's start here. Any spraying scheduled for Broward County right now?
Hi. No, there's no aerial spraying schedule right now. We do have ongoing truck larva siding, and that's also considered spraying, but it's an organic material. And we have truck spraying for adult siding as well in various parts of the county.
And I know, Kate, Miami-Dade has frequent truck spraying and has a schedule that they publish online. Do we know of any Miami-Dade aerial spraying that's on the schedule right now?
Right now, no. They've done aerial spraying a couple of times this summer, but they don't have anything else on the schedule at this point.
What do we know about the spraying that has happened in Miami-Dade County so far this year, Kate?
So in Miami-Dade and also in the Palm Beach County, Monroe County, and Broward, officials have been using the pesticide Nailed to spray for salt marsh mosquitoes, which are aggressive nuisance mosquitoes, but they don't transmit diseases, at least in humans. And that's something that's different from last year when aerial spraying was with the pesticide Nailed was being used as sort of like an all-out attempt to get a handle on the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which carries the Zika virus.
Anton covers mosquito control program for Broward County. He's with the county. He's with us via Skype. The use of the aerial spraying in Broward County, did you use the Nailed over Weston?
We did recently use aerial spraying with Nailed over Weston, and we did that. The reason we did that was we got several thousand requests from that area, In addition, these elected officials in the West requested us to do aerial spraying.
And so I want to ask about the protocols of the decision to make that action. The use of NALID, how frequently have you been using it? How long has Broward County used NALID?
We've been using that chemical for a long time, much longer than me. however, it's not very frequent. On average, we would do aerial spraying with NALID over an area maybe once a year on average. And I look back over the last 10 or 15 years how we did it, so it's very infrequent for us. And when we do, the dosage of the chemical that we use is very, very small. This is about approximately one tablespoon diluted in enough water to spray over an entire acre. So it's not a whole lot.
So, An, can you talk a little bit more about sort of the decision to use NALID as far as what concerns you're hearing from residents of Weston and also Southwest Ranches? What's the situation there that you decided it's necessary to do aerial spraying?
So there's a few things. There's state regulation is that, depending on the number of calls, when it's deemed high, and in this case, it's deemed extremely high for the number of spray requests that we received.
How many calls were you getting?
We were averaging about 2,000 spray requests a day countywide, and most of them were coming from the south and west and part of the county, Weston and Southwest Ranches, for example.
And on these callers would request aerial spraying, or they were just general calls about, there's lots of mosquitoes in my backyard?
It's essentially, there's lots of mosquito, come help us.
Okay.
The other protocol is that we conduct what's called landing rates. What it is our entomologists will go out in that area and essentially just count the number of mosquito that will land on his arm. And in this case, we didn't even need to do that because as soon as you go out in this part of the county at the point before the aerial spraying, folks would be covered with mosquito, that practically the whole body. And we would get so many requests, just come and help us. In addition, so we try to do the truck spraying and backpack spraying. Unfortunately, in many parts of the county, fortunately also, is that the lots are so big, and particularly in the Southwest Ranches area, that the truck spraying does not get to people's backyard, which is where folks would like to congregate and, you know, have barbecue and those kind of things. Mm. And that's why the necessity for the aerial spraying.
And so as you're assessing all of this, you've got your phone calls, you've got an arm full of mosquito bites, so you know that the mosquito population is high. What's the next step to, and you have inaccessible landscape that you can only get to from the air. What's the next step to decide that NALID is the right chemical versus the BTI, which is a different type of treatment that you use?
Sure. Now, different mosquito require different treatment. The mosquito that carry virus, the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the most effective way to go after them is when they're in the larvae stage. And the reason for that is because the Aedes aegypti mosquito flight all day long, they bite all day long, and they're container. So when they're in one place, which is when they're in larvae stage, is when we use a BTI product to go after them. And that's been very effective for us. Now, the salt marsh mosquito, they don't breed in Broward County typically. They typically breed in the Everglades. So because they don't breed here, there's no larvae here for us to go after. So the only other way to go after them is when they're in adult phase. And they came in a few weeks ago. Our county experienced a prolonged storm. And along with that storm, the billions of mosquitoes came in from the Everglades. And the way to go after them is to go to adulticide, which is to spray different chemicals by truck, by backpack, and then in this limited case, by airplane.
So you mentioned that aerial spraying with NALID is not the most effective way necessarily to target the Aedes aegypti mosquito that carries Zika. Why were officials using it last year against the Aedes aegypti mosquito if it isn't the most effective way?
Well, I'm not sure who you meant by official, we never use it to target the Aedes aegypti mosquito. I know the CDC recommend that as a last resort, but we have never done it.
And you also mentioned the other methods, the truck spraying, the backpack spraying. Those don't use Nailed. Is that right, On?
That's correct. We use a different product altogether.
And why is that?
Because for the aero spraying, they're very limited product that we can use. And unfortunately, all of them are insecticides, and unfortunately, all of them comes with some kind of trade-off. And that's why Nailed is used. And it's been used throughout the country, and not just in South Florida.
Sure. In the United States, it's been used since 1959, as we know. But is the trade-off with Nailed somehow less than the trade-off with other potential chemicals you could use from aerial sprayers?
Right now, for aerial spraying, there's very limited choices. Nailed is one of the product. The other one has some significant trade-off as well. However, we're working with some university and chemical manufacturer company right now to hopefully come up with a more friendlier product to use in aero spraying. We're not quite there yet, but we're working hard at it.
Anton is the director of mosquito control for Broward County with us via Skype. Kate Stein covers the environment for us here at WLRN. Some of those trade-offs were highlighted recently, Kate, in a study from the University of Michigan that came from China looking at the effect of Nailed and motor skills of infants. What did the study find, and how should South Floridians look at this kind of research?
Right. So the study looked at 24 different pesticides in 200 infants in China. It was not a study on Nailed exclusively. But the researchers found that infants who had traces of Nailed in umbilical cord blood scored a little bit lower on tests of motor skills, fine motor skills and visual motor skills. And the key there is that they scored slightly lower. So I've talked with a pediatric physical therapist about this, as well as the study researchers. And they say that this study basically shouldn't be used to decide whether or not we use Nailed in South Florida.
Why not?
Well, the study found, so there's a, I talked with the researchers about the scale that they measured these motor skills deficits on, and it's a little complicated, but basically a 5-point variation on the scale is within the normal range for the population, the 9-month-old infants that they were looking at. The study on Nailed found that there was about a 1-point deficit. Mm. So there's a range of 5 points, you know, plus or minus, that could be just normal developmental differences. For Nailed, it's just one point. And so it could just be that this was a normal, you know, a normal difference looking at this relatively small population of 200 infants. But the key here is that there's growing evidence that pesticides like Nailed can impact neurological development of children. And that's why researchers are encouraging more studies and, you know, caution as we use this pesticide.
And helping fuel some activists that don't want the use of Nailed in their neighborhoods. We saw a lawsuit filed against the governor, against the county mayor, against the head of the Centers for Disease Control thrown out this week. Is that lawsuit dead? It tried to stop the spraying of Nailed in Miami-Dade County.
So the lawsuit in this particular form is dead. The judge who was looking at the request basically found a couple of shortcomings. There wasn't a lot of clarity in the request for the injunction on why the federal court should be the one that's making the decision or on which laws might actually be violated. And so he dismissed the lawsuit for the time being, but he also gave the plaintiff 60 days to amend and resubmit, hopefully with a lawyer. They didn't have a lawyer at the time of this hearing on Wednesday.
And the judge's admonition was to get a lawyer.
Right. Yeah. But after this decision, lawyers from the county, from Miami-Dade County, said they'd be willing to have a conversation about aerial spraying with the plaintiffs. So it remains to be seen if that conversation will happen or, you know, if they'll go back to the courts again.
It has been almost 1 year since Zika was found in South Florida, and we're talking about mosquito spraying as we're in the thick of mosquito season here on the Florida Roundup. Let's go to line one in Little Havana. Jeffrey, you are on the Florida Roundup. Your thoughts. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yes. I've learned recently about the spreading of knowledge. I saw actually a post on Facebook, and just doing some reading, I became very, all the things you're talking about the possibly detrimental effects of knowledge, I became very concerned. And I know even though the EPA says it's safe, I know that, in Europe, the European Union, they've banned it for use in agriculture because of the negative effects. And I know there was an article, I don't know if you can highlight anything about it in the New Times, about Miami-Dade County actually lying about when they were asked, oh, I hear it's banned in Europe, and they said, no, it's not. And I'm wondering, it seems like there's not a whole lot of transparency. I'm wondering why the county would lie about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeffrey, we got it. Thanks for the phone call. Kate, can you shine a light on this?
Yeah. So I don't know that the county actually lied about the ban in the European Union. There's been a lot of confusion about that ban because it's a little unclear whether the EU actually actively banned, like forbade the use of NALID, or whether it was a question of the manufacturer not applying and registering the chemical for use in the EU, because there's not a big market there. I did talk with the manufacturer. They're unwilling to use the term ban, and the actual language on the European Union website that regulates pesticides is not approved.
Right.
So it's a little unclear about the ban.
And this also gets to the regulatory strategy that the European Union uses for pesticides and insecticides versus what American regulators use. The European regulatory strategy is what it calls the precautionary principle, which is essentially is if there's no scientific data that is able to allow regulators to evaluate the risk, then they can stop the distribution and not approve it. Whereas in the United States, actual harm has to be shown in order for a product to be pulled from a market.
That's right. And actually, we've seen this play out in the U.S. with the EPA's recent decision on another pesticide that's similar to NALID called chlorpyrifos. There's been a fair amount of evidence that chlorpyrifos can cause neurological impacts on infants. And as recently as November 2016, under the Obama administration EPA, there was a push to outlaw chlorpyrifos. But with the new EPA coming into power with the Trump administration, that push for a ban has been reversed. And so the reason that they reversed that potential ban was that they just didn't feel there was enough evidence that it caused harm.
The actual harm limits, so to speak, that the United States regulators
right.
have. Anton, as director of mosquito control in Broward County, bring it back for your residents. What are the notification efforts that you have to go through before you put a plane in the air with NALID?
So before we do any aerial spraying at all, we issue a news release, it's published on our website, and then we also make individual calls to residents that are registered with the Department of Agriculture because they may have some chemical sensitivity. In addition, we work with the cities, in this case, Southwest Ranches and Weston, to do what's called a reverse code red, where they notify individual residents through a robocall throughout their cities.
You talked about calls to registered residents. What is that registration? How does one get involved with that?
It's fairly simple. It's kept up by the Department of Agriculture. So essentially, there's one page form that you fill out that lists why you want to be notified. And the advantage for a resident when you do that is when we spray or anyone else that are spraying any kind of insecticides in your area, we're all supposed to notify you. And so that covers our residents for all the insecticide company that may be working in your area.
Anton is director of mosquito control for Broward County with us from his office via Skype. Kate Stein covering the environment for us here at WLR. And thanks to both of you for joining us on the roundup today.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Still to come on the program, the living conditions behind bars in some of Florida's prisons. That's next as the roundup continues. We're We're back on the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening to WLRN. Last weekend in Central Florida, temperatures hit 90 degrees, and they've stayed there. For women prisoners serving time at the Lowell Correctional Institution just south of Gainesville, the past week has meant hot conditions without a regular supply of clean water. Just the latest problem of living conditions behind bars in Florida's prisons. Inmates have been found to live with flooded bathrooms, inadequate health care, and abusive guards. Julie Brown has documented all of this as an investigative reporter for our partner, the Miami Herald. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, Julie. Nice to see you again.
Nice to be here.
The situation at Lowell, south of Gainesville, what is it like here on this Friday afternoon?
Well, it's very hot, as you can imagine. They did repair their water pump, so they do have water flowing for the toilets and for the showers, but it's still not drinkable. They did some testing over the past couple of days, and one of those tests came back as it not being drinkable, so that they'll at least not have any running drinking water through the weekend, probably.
It was a thunderstorm of sorts that knocked this water pump out?
Yes, that's what we were told.
Do we have any evidence of that?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, I don't doubt it necessarily, but this prison really has a history of a lot of problems with the facility itself.
And this is a state-run facility, is
that
right?
That's correct.
Okay,
that's correct.
So it's the state agency, the Department of Corrections, that's responsible for its conditions, or is there another regulatory agency that can come in there and look at, frankly, the health of the situation and the ability to have potable water?
I think that the only other agency that would have oversight over the prison besides the state would be probably the federal government.
Department of Health?
No, the Department of Health said that the only jurisdiction that they have as far as health is the kitchen and the food serving facilities.
This latest challenge at Lowell is just the latest challenge at Lowell and just the latest challenge for these state-run correctional institutions. You've been documenting these problems of access to health care and abusive guards and abuse amongst prisoners that's allowed to happen. What is the culture? Is it changing at all? We have a relatively new secretary in the Department of Corrections who's been there now for a couple of years.
Yes.
Are you seeing the needle move on some of these prisoner conditions?
I think somewhat. I think that she has set a tone to send a message to staff that this kind of abuse isn't going to be tolerated. She has made some headway with getting rid of some of the bad apples, so to speak, in the prison system. But I do think that a lot of it is almost out of her control because these individual prisons are almost their own fiefdoms. Hmm. So it really is up to the wardens in the way they want to run it. And certainly they don't have, you know, the cover-up continues.
Different case altogether, one that stems from the Dade Correctional Institute in South Dade County, and this is the case of Daryl Rainey, which you've documented as well, the inmate who died in a prison shower several years ago. His death officially ruled by the Miami-Dade medical examiner as accidental. There's a hearing coming up for physical evidence that the family of Daryl Rainey wants an independent examiner to look at. What's at stake?
Well, this is a big case. This is a big hearing. It's going to happen later today. No one besides the Miami-Dade medical examiner has seen this evidence that shows that, as she's ruled, that he did not get burned in that shower, and she has and the state attorney. The county has been reluctant to release it. At first, they denied our request. The Miami Herald had a request to have an independent pathologist looked at it, and they denied our request, saying, well, the family doesn't want it to happen.
Right.
And now they're denying the family's request to have the slides sent to their pathologist in Michigan because they cite some administrative code that said if you want to look at it, you got to come look at it in our office. We're not going to send them to you, which is absurd because they do it all the time. I mean, I've interviewed pathologists who all the time order slide recuts and get them sent to their office.
As we're here on this Friday afternoon, the hearing is scheduled this afternoon. Could the family's independent investigator have this physical evidence by early next week, depending
yes.
upon the ruling this
yes.
week today?
Yes, yes. And it's also possible that the judge could rule that not only the independent pathologist, but our pathologist might even be able to have access to
By
to
your
to,
pathologist, yeah, you mean the independent possible. Pathologist from the Miami Herald?
Yeah, it's possible.
And what are we looking at here? We're looking for evidence of scalding in the skin tissue?
That's correct. There is a certain certain properties that you see when it's under a slide that show that he would be burned.
Then what? What happens next?
Well, I mean, certainly if it shows evidence that he was burned, then I guess that the state attorney and the medical examiner are going to have to answer a lot of tough questions.
Well, sure. And those tough questions have been asked since their initial report came That's out, correct. And they continue to stand by it. The medical examiner saying there wasn't evidence of scalding in this tissue. And the state's attorney in Miami-Dade County has ruled this an accident. No charges.
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, as you know, there's been a lot of blowback with State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle,
right,
with the Miami-Dade Democratic Party, saying that they want her to resign as a result of this case.
And ruling coming out potentially as soon as this afternoon. Julie Brown, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Always great to see you. I know you're on your way to court right now, as a matter of fact. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
That is the roundup for this week. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. Terrence Shepard directs the news. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Our program director here at WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor, Jason Zabka. Thanks to all our guests and our callers this week here on the Florida Roundup. You can find a podcast of this at iTunes. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.